Blog Talk Radio.
Finest people.
Where is thy salute?
For presenting yourselves on this battlefield. I give you thanks.
This is our army. To join it, you give homage.
I give homage to Scotland. And if this is your army, why does it go?
We didn't come here to fight for them.
Oh, the English are too many.
I am William Wallace.
William Wallace is 7 feet tall.
Yes, I've heard. Killed men by the hundred. And if he were here, he'd consume the English with fireballs from his eyes and bolts of lightning from his arms. I am William Wallace. And I see a whole army of my countrymen here in defiance of tyranny. You've come to fight as free men. And free men you are. What will you do with that freedom? Will you fight?
Fight against that? No! We will run!
And we will live. Aye. Fight and you may die. Run and you'll live. At least a while. And dying in your bed, many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
When you have a dream, it doesn't often come at you screaming in your face. Dreams always come from behind you, not right between your eyes. It sneaks up on you. Sometimes a dream almost whispers. Whispers, it never shouts. Very hard to hear. So you have to, every day of your lives, be ready to hear what whispers in your ear. It very rarely shouts.
That moment in time was one of the darkest moments I've had in my whole life. My motivation was out the door, like I just wanted to give up.
I need you to be who you're supposed to be. Don't let nobody stop you from being who you're supposed to be. Don't let nobody out-talk you. Don't let nobody tell you the doors are shut. Don't let nobody tell you that opportunities don't exist. Don't let nobody tell you that. I need you to be who you're supposed to be, because when you are who you're supposed to be, you're superhuman.
I don't want to delude you because this is a career-ending injury.
Listen to me. You got fear and you got faith. And I've decided not to walk in fear, but to walk in faith. There's greatness in you. Are you hearing me? There's greatness in you. And you mean to tell me you're never going to reach your full potential? You mean to tell me you're never going to be what you've been called to be? That you're not going to do what you've been called to do because you are afraid? Some things don't come. They just not going to come to you because you want it as bad as you want to breathe. You got to put up the dupes, and you got to be willing to fight that thing out. They're not giving out success, but you can earn it. You can take it. I need you to take it. Don't let the distractions distract you.
I would have never started skateboarding.
So whatever you do, man, don't give up. Don't quit. Now listen to me closely. Just because you failed doesn't make you a failure. And when life hits you, you gotta keep going. Just don't quit.
In order to achieve greatness, you have to go through a lot of pain. You definitely have setbacks, but in order to achieve that success, you have to push through.
If you hit an oak tree 1,000 times in 1,000 different spots, what's going to happen? Absolutely nothing. But if you hit an oak tree 1,000 times in the exact same spot, you know what's going to happen? You're going to bring it down. You're going to do the impossible. You're not only a special person created at a special time. You got something special inside of you.
You have to believe that you can do something that nobody else has done. And somehow that concept has to become reality.
You got greatness all inside of you. But your problem is you a scaredy cat. You soft. And every time it get hard, you quit and you give up. And I'm telling you, if you would be willing to fight your way through it, if you would be willing to fight your way through this battle, fight your way through cancer, fight your way through that academic struggle, fight your way through divorce, fight your way through it. If it was easy, everybody would do it. You gotta fight your way through it. You gotta fight the fear, because guess what? Fear ain't bigger.
Let's talk to Will in Arizona. Thanks for holding her on the air.
First off, I am a Prison TV Planet member.
Awesome, brother. Go ahead and into your points, and I'll hold you over if need be.
If you really want to have an unbridged idea of what is going on today, look at, it's actually a YouTube video, but it's a documentary, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. He actually kicked out a lot of the bankers because they were trying to implode Germany after World War One. And it was the bankers. And when I was watching that, it was 5 hours long. And I started listening and saying to myself, wait a minute, they are just repeating history. But because we are so dumbed down in the sense of our historical knowledge.
Well, I haven't seen the documentary you're talking about. People can, I guess, check it out for themselves.
In the very well-made, excellent and moving documentary called Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. I want you to do something for me as well, and I would really appreciate it. Before you listen to this interview, I want you to watch the documentary. I know you want to listen to this program right away, but if you haven't already seen it, I want you to stop this program right now and go watch the documentary first. And I'm adamant about watching the documentary because one of the biggest hurdles that the majority of people seem to have, they're basically just kind of set in their ways, and they argue that they already know everything that they need to know concerning this topic. Well, I can promise you, people, you don't know one-tenth of it.
I seriously had a panic attack after I watched that documentary, The Greatest Story Never Told. And for days afterward, I was really shook up. It had such a profound impact on me, and everything started making so much sense, and I felt so... I mean, I've always felt kind of betrayed by the powers that be, but I felt more betrayed than ever. Mm-hmm. And I started looking back on my entire life, and yep, looking back at all the movies that I'd seen.
I just couldn't believe it. I thought if they could pull off this, then anything is possible. Anything.
Yeah.
You know, and that one, you know, I would encourage anybody watching this or listening to this to watch that hasn't seen that documentary to watch it. Go back
with an open mind.
Open mind and listen to that interview that you did with Dennis Wise recently.
But that's most likely what got us censored from iTunes, by the way, too, that show.
Yeah, well...
That show is what we're not allowed to talk about. It's just off limits, you know?
And that's what, when I was going through that sort of panic attack realization, that was it. That was the big red flag. I was like, oh my God, like of course we're not being told the truth because we're not allowed to talk about this issue. When you're not allowed to talk about something... then that's like the red flag right there. If it's off limits, then that's the thing you need to talk about the most.
And the rule to remember is that history is written by the winner.
I can promise you, people, you don't know one-tenth of it.
All right, everybody, Joseph Gibson Podcasting here, understanding the times in which we live today. Let's do a World War II documentary tonight. See how that works out for us. Go ahead and play it.
Considered all the possibilities, historically and I thought accurately. Over and over, we discussed the strengths, actual and potential, of our probable enemies. France. Confused and helpless in the hands of fascist leaders. England. Citadel of appeasement. The United States? No army, navy, or air force. My expert in that country gave me most satisfactory reports.
I think it is a mistake to underestimate America, Herr Eberlein.
Do you question my statistics?
All I know is that the United States is the industrial phenomenon of the world.
I'll stick to my figures, Herr Schloss. To win wars, you need manpower. We know how many men the United States can put into the field. This number is limited by the number of men necessary for production of the materiel with which to fight. The ratio of workers to soldiers is fixed.
Herr Eberlein, have you ever considered the possibility of woman labor?
American women? Come. The most decadent women on the face of the earth. Let me quote you some statistics about the women of America. Last year, 1938, they spent more for cosmetics than the United States Navy did for ships, more for silk stockings than the United States Air Force spent for planes. Flirts, cocktail drinkers, pleasure lovers, loafers, a race of playgirls pampered and spoiled by their sentimental American men. How different from the women of Germany, who trained like soldiers, who bred babies to wage this war, and are now producing the goods for our grown soldiers on the fighting front. And all this, without lipstick, American women, bah!
This I accepted. I was to make many mistakes before my downfall. But none, however spectacular, was more grave than my contempt that day for American women. The moment was right. I invaded Poland. My war was begun. Meanwhile, in the United States, there was a restless stirring.
and land lease be to operate factories appeared overnight. How was it possible for America to achieve such production and at the same time build an army? And the amazing reports came in from my agents in the United States. The answer was that 20% of American industrial manpower was woman power. Legions of American women were massing to stop my advance across the world, forsaking the round of revelry for the grim tasks of war. It was the first time I had heard of the hidden army.
It may have been the first time, Herr Hitler, but it was not to be the last time. The hidden army was going to haunt you till your dying day. Tomorrow, isn't it? Or the day after tomorrow? Came and we were in the war 100%. The Axis believed it was ready for it. Axis statistics, careful and accurate, had forecast this army, this Air Force, this Navy. But in the production estimate, the Axis was wrong, because the forecast had miscalculated the potential strength of the hidden army, the women of American industry. Across the Atlantic to Berlin, across the lake to Tokyo, went news of the upheaval in American life. Millions and millions of women who had never lifted a finger outside their own homes now suddenly resolved to set the world house in order. These were the uniforms of the hidden army. These their weapons. And these the results they helped to achieve. It must have called for some pretty fancy explaining by the statistical expert, Herr Eberlein.
But Herr Eberlein, it will pass, I tell you. These women are the unemployed, the publicity seekers, the seekers after novelty, the crank, playgirls with new toys. It's just a vogue, nothing more. It will pass.
But it did not pass. Not yet. Invasion came to North Africa. Working side by side with men, women have helped weld the landing craft that disgorged equipment and American fighting men. Women have rivet the planes that rained hell through the days and nights. Women have manufactured the radio tubes that flashed the news that the first major Allied invasion was accomplished triumphantly. And in doing all this, they had earned the respect of the men beside them. There were some jobs that a woman could do even better than men. Jobs, for instance, that required a delicate touch and sensitive fingers. Yet, the American woman, to every man's surprise, had won her industrial spurs. And this, in addition to about 100,000 women in the Army, Navy, and Marines, and the brave nurses risking their very lives on the battlefront. By the end of 1943, the hidden army had grown to be nearly 30% of war production labor. But by that time, all over the globe, American arms had passed from defense to offense. This meant greatly increased demands for materiel and greatly increased demands for men. Casualties had to be replaced. Invasion forces had to be built. And as our armed forces grew, so did their demands for equipment, supplies, food, materiel of all kinds. The need for women grew desperate. And thousands of women answered the call. But then a strange thing happened. 1 month, the hidden army, which had mushroomed, suddenly stopped growing. The following month was even more disturbing. The papers reported a slight falling off in production. Some were too tired in the morning to face the assembly line or the workbench. Some found that defense work interfered with their shopping. A few members of the hidden army, it seemed, had earned enough for the fur coat they coveted and returned to their pre-war existence. Perhaps the war news looked swell, and the compulsion to work was dissipated in the confident talk of victory just around the corner. Others quit for sounder reasons. Transportation was a problem. It was distressingly difficult to be both a housekeeper and a patriot. The kids needed looking after, and the house somehow refused to run itself when 8 hours a day were spent at the plant. But by far the most common reason was that women were not accustomed to the long hours of hard work. Shortages appeared. American planes found themselves lacking bearing assemblies. Delicate parts for electronic equipment were low. And American wounded became American dead. Of a sudden, the war was right in the American home. The government regrets to inform. That in war there can be no such thing as a slight falling off in production, because there's no such thing as a slight death. By early 1944, the draft voters were falling behind. The demands for young men for the new invasion forces were imperative. These young men had to come largely from the deferred, the fathers, those doing essential industrial work. Reclassification was called for. This at a time when stories drifted in from the cold Italian mountains, the malaria-ridden Pacific jungles, the watery graves. Women the country over began to recognize war for what it was, a grim, tough, unromantic battle to the death, in which every man, woman, and child had a stake. If the American home is to be preserved, if the tragedies of other families in tortured lands are not to be duplicated here, the Axis must be brought to its knees. The hidden army drew fresh recruits. Its ranks grew to nearly 18 million. Many of these women came from walks of life not previously considered. The mothers...
They sent the troops into the Rhineland and big military kills.
On March 12, 1938, the German army marched into Austria. They were met with cheering crowds as they crossed the border.
So badly to get to Messina ahead of Montgomery, who should have been there.
For George Patton, the most important explosion of the nasty Sicilian campaign would come not from a gun, but from a glove. In Sicily, George S. Patton's thoughtless and impatient worship of military courage was to turn against him the kind of forces he was least able to turn back. He went to a field hospital to visit the wounded. It was very difficult on Patton. He was very emotional.
When he came to a soldier who had combat exhaustion or combat fatigue, what they called shell shock in World War I, Patton just couldn't stand it anymore, lost his temper, drew his glove, and slapped the soldier.
News that Patton had slapped not one but two soldiers in Sicily would turn Patton's moment of triumph into a disaster. Eisenhower angrily ordered him to apologize to his entire army. In one case, his magnetism turned the moment of humiliation into something of a triumph. The men assembled to listen to his speech of apology would not let him get started.
They began chanting something to prevent him from speaking because they did not believe that he owed them an apology. And so they kept chanting and cheering, and Patton choked up and began to cry and walked off.
The man he had slapped would say of Patton, "I think he was suffering a little battle fatigue himself." But now Eisenhower was fighting loud cries for Patton's scalp, and there were widespread doubts about his stability.
You never knew what he was going to say, and sometimes never knew what he was going to do next. He was impulsive and impetuous. He wore his opinions on his sleeve, and he had opinions on everything under the sun.
The Germans weren't the only ones who regarded Patton as the Allies' best fighting general. The U.S. High Command, as exasperated as they were with him, knew there was critical work to come for such a fighter, and he would be vital to Operation Overlord, the assault across the English Channel on Hitler's fast-hardening fortress Europe. Patton didn't know that.
In the autumn of 1943, Patton was in virtual exile in Sicily. Seventh Army had been stripped away from him. He felt he had no future. And yet, while he was undergoing literally the tortures of the damned, wondering if he would ever see another command again, he was actually under consideration for two major commands. One was the command of the Anvil Force, which was going to invade southern France in the summer of 1944, and the other was as the commander of Third Army, which is the job that he eventually got.
The men who would command Overlord knew their Patton well. Eisenhower, who would be at the top, Montgomery, who would be temporary commander of ground forces, and Patton's former corps commander, Omar Bradley, who would command the American ground armies. Patton was ordered to England in January of 1944 to command Third Army, then forming in the United States. But meanwhile, the Allies would use his formidable reputation with the Germans in the war's greatest deception.
Patton was brought up as the fictitious commander of a fictitious command. That deception plan called for the creation of an army that consisted of nothing of about 200 radio operators who filled the air with traffic. The deception plan, which was passed on to the German by their agents that had been turned by the British, Patton was to attack across the Pas-de-Calais with this fictitious army group.
The ruse would keep the desperately needed German panzer units defending the Pas-de-Calais from reinforcing Normandy. Meanwhile, Patton's mouth made new trouble for him at an English social club in Knutsford. He allegedly suggested carving up the post-war world between Britain and the United States, leaving out Russia.
It slipped through the censors and became a cause célèbre. Calls went out for Patton's head, for his relief, and it very nearly cost him Third Army.
If I was reduced to colonel, I'd demand the right to command one of the assault regiments.
Both Eisenhower and George Marshall felt that the way to control Patton was to put him under the command of someone who could command him and administer him with an even hand. And they certainly felt that Omar Bradley filled that bill nicely.
Politics turned back into war on June 6, 1944. On D-Day, the Allies stormed across the English Channel into Normandy, and at Omaha Beach, held on by the skin of their teeth. As the fighting raged, Patton waited impatiently to lead Third Army into action. When the call came, he would write new and indelible chapters into the history of war. When Patton and his Third Army finally arrived in Normandy on July 6th, 1 month later, he found a situation much graver than the one imagined by the planners at this stage. Casualties were severe, and the Allies were bogged down by fierce German resistance and an impenetrable tangle of victories. The desperately needed advance was nowhere in sight, and recriminations filled the air. The failure of the British to punch through at Cannes, General Bradley conceived and put into effect the thunderous Operation Cobra. It would be Patton's job to exploit any success with his armored columns. The American attack began behind 34,000 tons of crushing aerial bombing in the area of Saint-Lô, followed by several days of hard ground fighting. Then suddenly, the German front began to collapse. A full-scale breakout from the tangle of hedgerows into the open plains was in reach. Eisenhower knew it was time to cut Patton loose. Warfare would never be the same. The crust has been broken. We're about to eat the pie. Patton's tanks shot forward in a frenzy of spectacular battles and advances that shattered the German left flank in Normandy. Marshall was right when he had said, Patton is the man with the drive and imagination to do the dangerous things in the facts.
The greatness, the fame of General George S. Patton, Jr. was achieved in a nine-month period in the ETO in Europe, starting in August 1st, 1944, and continuing through to May 8th of 1945. That's where Patton achieved his greatness.
The end of July, beginning of August of 1944, were Patton's golden moment. What had been a stalemate in Normandy was now a breakout of the pursuit. He watched his units move across France, sometimes at the rate of 40 or 50 miles a day. I mean, this is what you train for, is to see your army on the loose defeating your enemy. Patton was simply enjoying himself as perhaps no commander before or after.
At Evranches, Patton achieved what was described as pushing 200,000 men and 40,000 vehicles through what amounted to a straw. Every manual on road movement was ground dust. Patton bridled at what he thought was a missed opportunity on the part of his superiors when a failed German counterattack at Mortain allowed a vast encirclement of German armies in the Argentin-Falaise area. Patton felt that he had been held back from closing the gap between himself and Montgomery and sealing the Germans in.
Monty was pressing down from the north. Patton was pressing up from the south to close the gap and bag the German. Boundary line across Argentine. Patton was not to go above that line. Patton pleaded with General Bradley to break through the line and close the gap. He said, let me go, Brad, and I'll chase those goddamn limeys right into the sea.
Some thousands of Germans got out, but mostly without their armor. Patton was smoldering. And now, with the loss of time at Falaise, his sprint to the Seine was too late to cut off the Germans there, and he was ordered to stop. Patton was content when General Jacques Leclerc's 3rd French Division was allowed to take Paris. He thought it would free him to drive full tilt into Lorraine. It was a time for hot pursuit, not consolidation, but a furious Patton soon found himself confined to a static campaign before Metz, pinned in place not only by stubborn German defenses, but by a withholding of gasoline that bolted his armor.
God damn it, my men can eat their belts, but my tank's gonna have gas.
But the truth was that by August 1944, the Third Army had gone so far and so fast, it had crucially overstretched its supply line. Patton took desperate measures, including stealing from Montgomery's supply line.
He just stopped that column that was headed north to go to General Montgomery. He just said, dump it right there, and truck after truck, dump it right there. And he just had them dump about 10 truckloads of gasoline right there on the side of the road. And we had gasoline for a little while.
In times of stalemate, soldiers found time to poke fun at his frailties.
The voice was high-pitched, extraordinarily high-pitched. And when you went by the office door, if the phone rang and he picked it up, he'd say, jump, Patton. That was his voice. It was in Congress.
A figure of fun was his ill-tempered dog, Willie. Cartoonist Bill Mauldin, after visiting with Patton, wrote, Willie had his beloved boss's expression and lacked only the ribbons and stars. I stood in that door staring into the 4 meanest eyes I'd ever seen. But there were no smiles in the Lorraine campaign. By November, bitter battle of attrition in the worst winter weather in 38 years. He drove his men.
There are more tired division commanders than there are tired divisions.
Again, the guy. Hitler launched a huge surprise attack spearheaded by two Panzer armies. It knifed deeply through the lightly defended Ardennes forest. German Commander von Rundstedt's goal was to capture the key supply port of Antwerp and starve the Allied attack. In what history was called the Battle of the Bulge, Bradley urgently ordered General Patton to rush help to the north. The ominous bulge that the Germans drove into the Ardennes in December of 1944 split the American armies from the British and turned the momentum of the European war from the gates of Germany back into the vulnerable heart of Belgium. The pivotal road junction of Bastogne was cut off along with the 101st Airborne Division. Eisenhower called Patton to a desperate meeting.
Patton saw it as a glorious opportunity, so he told Eisenhower that he could turn his entire army, 250,000 strong, from facing east to a northerly direction. And it was bitter cold, 3 feet of snow, terrible fog, just miserable, miserable conditions, roads all icy. Eisenhower said, "George, be realistic. What the hell do you mean you can turn your men around in 48 hours? What can you do?" He said, "We can do it."
Well ahead of schedule, Patton's 3rd Army tanks turned north and raced for the besieged Bastogne.
I see him time and again on the road, encouraging his troops, inspiring him in an open jeep in bitter cold weather, encouraging him on.
It's a difficult thing to disengage and move laterally in the face of the enemy at any time, even a small unit. It's a dangerous move.
Even God got a steady stream of Patton admonitions in the form of prayers. "You seem to have given von Rundstedt every break in the book. You have to make up your mind whose side you're on. I've lost all patience with your chaplains." Patton's armor was not to be denied. On the day after Christmas, elements of the 4th Armored Division broke through spirited German resistance and entered Bastogne to relieve its bloody defenders. There was more tough fighting ahead, but Patton's race to the rescue had broken the back of the Germans' last major effort. The 3rd Army now duplicated its rampage across France in the bloody clearing of resistance before the Rhine.
"I've just pissed in the Rhine River. For God's sake, send gasoline."
Patton was ordered to bypass the city of Trier because it would take 4 divisions to capture it. He radioed tersely,
"I've taken Trier with 2 divisions. Do you want me to give it back?"
When Patton inspected the Ohrdruf and Buchenwald concentration camps 3rd Army had liberated, he became physically ill. He got the burgomaster of the nearest town to call all the citizens together, people who said they had never heard of a concentration camp before. He marched them through the place. The same day, the burgomaster and his wife returned home and committed suicide. His last military disappointment came when he was ordered to stop at Pilsen while the Russians occupied Berlin and Eastern Europe. The joy of receiving a 4th star was dimmed by Bradley's having gotten the promotion first. On May 7th, 1945, Germany surrendered. Patton understood the wild joy, but could not join in it.
When peace came to Europe, Patton was exhausted physically, mentally, morally, every which way. His exertions during the war had burned him out.
There seemed to be no future role for Patton. No one wanted him. He had visions of going to the Pacific, fighting with an army under MacArthur. MacArthur didn't want him. He ended up as the occupation commander in Bavaria, commanding 3rd Army in a role for which he was wholly unsuited. It was a depressing time when Patton went almost overnight from being a hero to being a man no one wanted any part of.
He returned to America on a bond tour. The hero's welcome that he received was barely enough to feed an ego bereft of the war that had fed it. He wondered whether the family he so awkwardly loved would be enough to sustain him in his remaining years.
I've become sort of a demigod, and I don't know if Fox hunting and sailing are going to divert me.
He returned to Bavaria to begin rebuilding and get a new government started. But again, he spoke self-destructively.
He feared that the Soviet Union was going to take control of all of Europe. He thought that the Germans would be excellent allies to use against the Russians. And he thought that the Germans and the Americans should band together now and take on the Russians.
In rebuilding Germany, he found the former Nazis the most capable and put them in key positions.
At a press conference, Patton was asked by a reporter why he had so many Nazis in key positions. Patton replied, "The Nazis, it's a party just like the Democrats and Republicans." As we walked down the hall after the conference, he remarked, "Stupid goddamn statement. I knew better, but I wouldn't give the son of a bitch the satisfaction of knowing it."
That was the final straw that caused his relief from command of the 3rd United States Army. Eisenhower would say, "I'm not moving George for what he's done, just for what he's going to do next." It was the end of their long friendship. A bitter Beatrice would later turn down invitations to the Eisenhower White House.
It was a very sad affair for all of us. A few of us went down to the train station to say goodbye to him, and there were tears in all of our eyes.
Caesar couldn't have been a supply sergeant in the 3rd Army. Oh, it's hell to be old, passé, end of it.
Fate stepped in for the weary hero. On December 9th, the day before he was to fly home, Patton was involved in a low-speed car crash while going hunting. No one else was hurt. Patton was thrown forward and instantly paralyzed, his neck broken. While Willie mourned and Beatrice was rushed to Heidelberg, where Patton was hospitalized, desperate doctors improvised a harsh device to relieve pressure on his shattered spine.
Fish hooks were obtained and put under his cheekbones to help traction on his back. He endured what I consider unspeakable pain.
This is a hell of a way to die.
After a blood clot caused his lungs to fill, General George S. Patton, Jr. died at age 60 on December 21st, 1945. Both his daughters reported visitations by his spirit.
A funeral train passed from Heidelberg to his final resting place at Ham, Luxembourg. It made numerous stops in terrible weather. It was raining, it was ugly, it was cold, it was dark. And yet wherever the train stopped, soldiers and ordinary citizens came forward to honor Patton, to put flowers on the train.
Among his last words heard by his beloved Beatrice were, "I guess I wasn't good enough." As had been the case many times in his magnificent life, he had spoken too quickly.
There was a tremendous outpouring of grief. Soldiers who knew him by reputation, soldiers who had served under him but never met him, were deeply affected by his death.
A correspondent said, "Georgie Patton didn't die from an automobile accident. He died of a broken heart when they took away his army." General George S. Patton was buried in the Ardennes soil in what he had called poor tank country. To the silent, beloved soldiers at whose head he would forever lie, he undoubtedly proclaimed his favorite greetings to his troops.
"I'm damn glad to be here."
Everybody, Joseph Gibson podcasting here, understanding the times in which we live today. All right, we got a caller here. It's a couple callers, actually. Go with the open up the phones here. 314. Go ahead.
Well, that was a very, very great man, Joseph.
A little documentary here tonight, you know, just playing a little something. Keep the night rolling. You know, I didn't really want to do a show, but I got to go in for surgery tomorrow, so I figured I'd do one. What the heck, I'll probably stay awake all night. So, you know, when they start putting that needle in your arm, and you never know when you're going to wake up. You don't know who they can whack me for all I know. You know?
Yeah, you never know, do you?
I don't know. What these who knows nowadays? I mean, for God's sake, the 4th of July free. How could we say we're even close to being free at all? I mean, we're all slaves to this globalist agenda. You know, one way or the other, there's so much corruption going on, you know?
Yeah, that George Patton is one of my favorite heroes. When I look back,
they don't make him like him anymore, do they?
No, unfortunately, they don't. And when I talk to him, my voice become a little wavery. Eyes become a little glassed over. But it's unfortunate the way the politics enter into people when they have a guided, spiritual guided towards success. And he had a lot of forethought also, but he was a great leader.
Yeah,
and sometimes I think that, you know, he thought he was reincarnated. He was reincarnated, but maybe the spirits called him home. You know, people, you don't know why you're here or the course of events that led to you being here. But you're here at a time and a moment in time. And when you are done, then that which sense you may call you on to yet another battle. But
you know,
a great
I don't know
person.
The history. I don't know the history of your life or whatnot, or how old you are or whatnot, and many things you've seen in your life. But I think about my life, and I think back to the places I've been, many, like in the 1990s, the bad places I was in, and all that I've seen. And I try to put myself back in that time period, in that situation, and try to move forward like I was living back in that time. And it tries to put myself in another dimension in my mind, like how, like, experience it and feel it and touch it again. And you just, I just can't grasp that reality. To live, relive it, it's just a faded memory. And you wonder how much time really matter, or how long does it really last? I mean, look at Adolf Hitler, for instance. You know, he built a country, a strong military, almost took over the world in a matter of, what, 10 to 12 years. You know, I mean, when you think about it. But then it was all over, done, you know?
He was another very marvelous strategy person also.
Yeah.
Believe it or not.
Yeah. I don't agree with all of that, but...
The Germans was no joke. War is hell, Gibson.
Yeah, it sure is.
And
war is hell.
You know, for you to put yourself in a person's feet, or people's feet, people's shoes, that is, it's hard to do. You're on that, you this side, and they on that side. And you know one thing about Patton, he used a black tank force, the 761st. Yeah, the 758 and 784. And I think, you know, the all black tank crew, and he told them that basically don't let your people down, and by all means don't let me down. And that was the type of person that he was.
Yeah.
That was the type of person he was.
I don't know if you caught the show or not. We did Friday night. It was a very good show, actually. We had a female call in, a mother. Her son was murdered. By the DEA, actually, and she told her story Friday night on this podcast, and it was a powerful show, actually. And you think back, you know, the hell that she's going through, and you know, and really the people that the men that shot her son, You know, I mean, I don't know what they're feeling inside. You know, like you just said, what you try to put yourself in other people's shoes, it's almost impossible. Because, you know, to take life like that, was it an accident? Was it cold-blooded murder? I mean, when things happen so fast and in the heat of the moment and you make an accident, you make a mistake, and it costs you your liberty for the rest of your life. You know, I've seen a lot of people in prison where they just, out of the heat of the moment, made a mistake, and it cost them their entire liberty and freedom for the rest of their lives, and they're confined in this square box in this area, and that's their life institutionalized, and it's like they're not, and really, I think that they're okay with it. Like, I've seen it in there where it's like you adapt, and then you come out here to society and say, look at all you're missing, but really we're in our own little prison ourselves when we're, you know, living our lives. We're in our own little box. You know, we just have a little more area to roam around in because we're still being controlled as individuals. We don't really have freedom anymore in this country. You just can't do what you want. There's regulations up the yin-yang. I mean, you know, and then on top of it, I'm bringing this up because look at her son, murdered. You know, you can die walking out your front door, literally, tomorrow morning, you know, and it's over.
Mm-hmm. Well, you never know the time, that hour, that time. And, you know, you look at the difference between today and what it was back during the 1940s and the difference in the mindset of the people. You know, Americans was more patriotic then than what I think they are today. I don't think you could ever today put together a fighting force like we had back during those times, whether it was in Europe or whether it was in the Pacific.
Storming the beach of Normandy, just imagine you're facing sure death, you know it. I mean, you know, and look at
Beach.
World War One. You know, I mean, man.
Mm-hmm. And people don't know that even in the Pacific theater with Japan, and there was many cases, in, you know, at the Coral Sea and Midway and where the United States, it's just like a flip of a coin. Things could have easily went the other way. Just a bank of clouds rolls through where your reconnaissance plane can't see the waters to see what's beneath those clouds, which was a task force, a U.S. task force. They couldn't see it. The clouds rolled in and hit them. It was just things like that that worked in the favor of the United States. It was as if it was a godsend.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. You know, and
we don't know how lucky we
are.
Yeah, and people don't know. You know, it's a shame. See, this is something that needs to be constantly played over and over, and your children have to be programmed into it to understand and know what it is that they're seeing and what they're experiencing today. And what they were experiencing back in those times. You had people look like a parade, Joseph, lining up to go fight.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
I know. You know, it's insane. It's insane. And the same thing, look at the other side. Look at the amount of Germans that died and were captured and they fought and to the end. I mean, you know, and the Japanese, look at them. They fought to the death. Those, I mean, they didn't, you know... I mean, you look at the human soul, you know.
When you got ready to, when we got close to the islands, right there, where you could launch your B-29s, where they could go in and bomb Japan, a Doolittle raid was a calling card. It didn't do the damage that they wanted to do, but it showed. It put something on their mind.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing. It's amazing, you know.
We're down to one carrier, the USS Enterprise. The USS Enterprise. That name should always ring supreme amongst our military, our navies.
I don't know too much about the USS Enterprise, actually. I'm ignorant of it.
The USS Empire, we was down. You know, when Japan struck, our carrier fleet was out. That's what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted the carrier fleet, but they were out to sea. And I think we had six carriers, Enterprise, Yorktown, the Hornet. And at one point there, we were down to like down to three, the Yorktown and the Hornet got damaged. Yorktown went down. Then you just had the Enterprise.
Yeah.
For a long time. The Big E.
And what fighting did that see?
Pardon me?
What fighting did that see? I mean, that was the only one that was left, right?
Yeah, that was the only one left. And you had to have a carrier with planes on it, and they had to get close enough, like when Doolittle raid, they had to get as close as they can so that the planes would have enough fuel to go get there and come and return either to the carrier. Well, they couldn't return to the carrier. They had to return to safe land. Some of them went over into China land. Some of them had to ditch in the sea.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. Amazing. And it's just, World War II was a huge shape lifter for the world. How close was the world to ever so changing? I mean, what would the United States have done if Hitler had conquered Russia, had conquered Africa, had conquered Britain? What would the United States have done? Do you think the United States would have held its own?
No, I don't think the United States. I don't know. I don't think so.
It would have been rough.
Germany was.
Yeah.
If I could say it like this, Germany was something else.
Yeah.
Even Patton said that they were something else. Stalin didn't believe. He just couldn't believe that Germany was going to attack Russia.
Mm-hmm.
German troops got within like 15 miles of Russia, or Moscow.
Yeah.
15 miles.
Yeah.
And what really helped them?
I got a documentary now that's playing. Actually, right now, I was going to probably the Soviets and when the Germans attacked the Soviets. Right now, I could play a little bit of that one. Still got some time left.
Got another caller out there. Let them have opportunity.
Yeah, he dropped actually. He dropped. He dropped it. You know, people are so impatient. Don't worry about it. It's a private caller. It wasn't Sarge. I know that. I don't know where Sarge has been the past couple nights, but. If it was Sarge, you know, I would say no, but he would have hung in there. But the private car, probably a crank caller, you know, someone.
I'm going to tell you, I like to call and talk to people of like mind and like substance.
Yeah.
And what I can offer is experience. I've lived a long time, luckily.
Mm-hmm.
And I can share experience, especially with the observation of people. You know, it's one thing to be able to read a book, but to be able to read people is a whole different thing. And I'm telling you, I wish that this country would bring back the draft where these young people would have to spend some time in that environment, a boot camp. I really do. You need hard, tough. You need hard, tough, kick-ass type of drill sergeants. In order to they either got it in them or they don't. And they don't know themselves. At least they would find out. If you cut out for it, if you're not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I just, yeah.
You know,
I
one of the reasons why Japan would not come on to the West Coast and invade America?
Why?
They say behind every blade of gun, every blade of glass, grass, there's an American with a gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our Second Amendment saves us, and they're trying to squeeze that as much as possible. How many people do you see actually walk around anymore armed, you know, or have a gun on them, you know, or openly or whatnot? I mean, you know, they got
it. Well,
you
know,
I only
save face now, Joseph, is these states. The states has to do what they supposed to be. You know, governors like DeSantis there in Florida should be more of the rule than the exception. The states have the ability to tell the federal government, we ain't going to do it.
Chicago there? What do you think about Chicago here? What was it? Let's see. 1-month-old baby among 130-plus shot in Chicago this week. as DHS and FBI stay focused on white extremists? You know, I mean, what's going on here? I mean,
that's
a
bunch
of
bull crap. This thing now, they're trying to, they're attacking white males. And you know, the sad thing about it, whites letting this shit happen to them. And I'm going to tell you something, Joseph. If whites don't get up off their ass, then we're going to be in some deep doo-doo.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
well, you know,
the
FBI, they're too busy worried about the latest grandma that went into the Capitol building and arrested her, you know, and said, you know, that's what they wanted, you know, and the white people are laying down taking it. We have over 400 people kidnapped that are sitting in there that should not be inside that jail right now for the crimes that they did commit, you know?
At the same time, the insurrections that was breaking into stores, looting and burning, they've been let free.
Yep.
They've been let free, Joseph.
Pathetic. And nobody else.
You know, in 43 days in Chicago, you had 575 people shot.
Crazy.
43 days. That was up to July the 1st, last Thursday. 575 people shot with 78 murders. That's like 14 people a day. Last year, you had 4,845. What in the hell is going on? And see, black folks and these black leaders, they can't say a damn thing. You got a black mayor. You got a black police superintendent. You got the second most powerful person in the state of Illinois, a black female, is lieutenant governor, a black attorney general, a black secretary of state. What the hell?
I know. I don't know. Hey, we got to have a change. We got to have a chance. People stand up. I'm going to stand up for my district. I'm going to tell you that right now. I'm going
to
run. I don't know what they'll do to make kidnap me. You know, I don't know what's going
to
happen.
You got to. You got to get back at them damn school board meetings. You got to take over them school boards, Joseph, because now they're targeting the kids.
Yep. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely correct. There is no doubt about that. Well, I'll play this I guess this little intro there. And, you know, here it is, Blog Talk Radio. Look, it's 12 midnight now. I'm the only guy in the chat rooms right now on Blog Talk Radio. The only one.
Yeah, people,
you know, well,
people
you know,
are burning
up their
money in the sky and eating pork, I guess.
Well, let me play a little bit of this Soviet documentary.
All right, then. I'm gonna listen to you on the Internet. But
gotcha.
I really appreciate the time. Thank you very much, sir.
All right.
And
thank
God
you so
bless
much,
America,
always.
Too. Yeah.
All right, thank you. God bless you, you know, and we need more people like yourself. All right, let's play this little documentary here, World War II continuing on.
Now, German troops were steaming eastward, taking up positions along the Soviet frontier. Hitler would later claim that the Red Army had been massed along the border, poised to invade Germany. Thus, he claimed Operation Barbarossa was a preemptive strike, a legitimate act of self-defense. But this was classic Nazi propaganda. Hitler wanted others, particularly in the neutral countries, to believe his invasion was justified. But few were fooled. In private, Hitler was more candid about his reasons for invading the USSR. It is only the possibility of Russia entering the war, he said, that now gives the English hope. If that hope is ruined, the English would have to make peace. Operation Barbarossa was an ambitious invasion plan, relying on the blitzkrieg tactics that had proved so effective against the French and British the previous year. The attack was to be spearheaded by four panzer groups. Their tank and motorized infantry divisions would seek to make rapid advances deep into enemy territory, leading to the encirclement and destruction of enemy armies on the frontier. The four panzer groups were commanded by Generals von Kleist, Hoeffner, Guderian, and Hoff. The ultimate goal was the capture of Moscow and the whole of European Russia. German strategy believed that their military superiority would lead to victory in 3 to 4 months. For the invasion, German forces were divided into three formations. Army Group North was to advance towards Leningrad. Army Group Center towards Moscow. And Army Group South toward Kiev and the Donetsk Basin. Army Group North and South each had one Panzer Group. Army Group Center had two, including 3rd Panzer Group, commanded by Hoff. Colonel Hermann Hoff had distinguished himself in the campaigns against Poland and France. He was 56 years old and referred to affectionately by his soldiers as Papa Hoff. Unlike Russia, where many senior officers had been killed in political purges, Germany could call on a wealth of experienced commanders. Most Soviet generals were in their 40s. In contrast, Guderian was 53, Höfner 55, and von Kleist 60. Panzer Group command staff arrived at the Soviet frontier during the winter of 1940. At first, only staff officers and signal troops were sent. The tanks were not to arrive until the very eve of the attack. By keeping his tanks in the west, Hitler wanted it to look like he still planned to invade Britain and prepared only defensive operations in the east. And so, an invasion army quietly assembled on Russia's doorstep. 1941, the Wehrmacht was at the height of its power. Its divisions had been brought to full strength. Morale was high after victory in the west. The last few months had been spent in intensive training for blitzkrieg operations. In contrast, the Red Army was dispersed across the Soviet Union, with many of its units still at peacetime strength. The forces of the border spent much of their time listening to political lectures. It would take 2 or 3 weeks of redeployment to properly reinforce them. And there was little preparation for defense. After all, the Red Army always expected to attack. Furthermore, Stalin was in no rush to fight a war against Nazi Germany. He knew the Soviet Union was not ready. In 1939, Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union had signed an alliance. But Stalin harbored no illusions. Intensive military construction was underway in the USSR. The Red Army had grown from a strength of 1.5 million troops.
When you let nature just do its thing.
Reoccupied the Rhineland, annexed Austria, and crushed the Sudetenland. He must be stopped, but no one dares. Council returns from Munich, where he is given in once more to Hitler. spite of existing treaties, France and England have abandoned Czechoslovakia. She will soon be carved up. Meanwhile, Daladier is wildly acclaimed. France has just broken her word. That doesn't matter, as long as peace is assured.
I am certain now, thanks to the wish for mutual concessions and to the spirit of collaboration which has strongly animated the action of the heads of government of the four great Western powers, that the peace is safe today.
France, worn out, divided, and obsessed by the memory of the slaughters of the First World War, heaves a sigh of relief. The French right, traumatized by the Popular Front and by the Spanish War, is obsessed with communism. August the 23rd, 1939. Von Ribbentrop, the German foreign minister, flies to Moscow. He's going to sign a non-aggression pact with Soviet Russia. The French left is stunned. How can this be possible? Hitler wants a free hand in the East. He got the intent to attack Poland. He knows this will mean war with England, but he doesn't want to fight on two fronts simultaneously. Stalin, faced with the delaying tactics of the Western democracies, has done an about turn. He wants to gain time. Summer, 1939. This is the third summer that paid holidays are given to French workers. The French are only beginning to enjoy the benefits of the Popular Front. September the 1st. At dawn, without declaring war, the German troops go into Poland. An irresistible force, 63 divisions, of which six are armored, supported by 2,000 planes. Faced with this, the Poles can only field 12 cavalry brigades and 300 planes. In spite of their legendary bravery, what can the Polish lancers do against the German armor? Consultations about the invasion of Poland. This time, there must be no drawing back. Paris and London send Hitler an ultimatum. If hostilities have not ceased before midday on September the 3rd, it is war. In Paris, Edouard Daladier doesn't dare to submit this decision openly to Parliament. He simply asks them to vote him exceptional military authority. In the French Assembly, the word war will not even be mentioned in the course of this debate, in which Deputy Louis Jacquinot took part.
I have to say that the Assembly wasn't unanimous. One must recognize that. And then there was a history of ambiguity, because the declaration of war was made under the guise of a vote for military authority. Daladier must be blamed for this method of presenting the declaration of war, as I told you. The truth is that negotiations were continuing, and I have the impression, in contrast to the British, that there was a hope all the same that the war wouldn't happen, or at least that the Germans wouldn't attack France.
What was the atmosphere like here?
Very disturbed. There really wasn't the enthusiasm of the First War. I was young in 1914. There was, without doubt, national unity, at least in the Assembly. The Assembly was unanimous. There wasn't, first of all, the eagerness. One must say the country, after draining itself as it did in 1914, didn't want to experience a second war. there was still a feeling that it wasn't right to excite the heart and not to show enthusiasm for a fight. France goes into the war, but holding back all the way. We will make war because it is thrust upon us. Each one of us is at his post on the frontiers of France. In this land of liberty, where respect for human dignity has one of its last refuges, you must combine all your efforts with a deep feeling of concord and fraternity for the welfare of the country. Long live France.
Vive la France.
Those who went to fight had already fought in the First World War. André Arquin, commander of the 34th Infantry Regiment. Monsieur Arquin, this plaque brings back memories to you, doesn't it?
Oui, on l'appelle de grands souvenirs.
Yes, it brings back great memories. I found myself there on August the 25th, 1914, mobilized in my turn, and in 1939, there I was again at the same place on the platform. The faces weren't the same, though. In 1914, they had an enthusiasm, they had something, it was exciting. Whereas in 1939, people were thoughtful. They thought of all the things they had left, because to make war again within 20 years is hard. Truly, two wars in one generation is too much. And France is not prepared for war. Some say it's the fault of the workers' strike and the Popular Front. Anyway, Hitler hasn't attacked France, say others. Defend our own country, yes. But who wants to die for Danzig? For Poland? Certainly, everyone will do their bit if necessary. But the heart's not in it. Not really. Deladier greets the British minister, Sir Anthony East, who represents the British cabinet and the countries of the empire.
Au ministère de la guerre, aux représentants the dominion of the Empire Britannique.
He's welcomed as a friend and a powerful ally. The government tries to reassure the French people by every means. But the pompous phrases of the propaganda written by the celebrated writer Jean Giraudoux ring terribly false.
Soldiers of France!
Soldiers of France, our own young men, go bravely once more to make history with love for the defense of honor and liberty. Our brave and good people who, in so many of your quiet family groups, assemble already with the memories and apprehensions of three wars. Look with confidence at our allies, these young English soldiers, at their equipment, their magnificent equipment. Courage, said the propaganda. Life goes on as before. Be still confident. Always show confidence. Total confidence. Believe that everything is entirely in order and all goes well. The vineyard workers, since the beginning of this season, have been harvesting throughout France, as one sees here in Champagne and in Alsace. They are the young soldiers who will be forming the French army. They will assure the security of the frontiers. When the Franco-British brothers in arms return to us to sample the pleasure of drinking and laughter with us, these wines, with a wartime date, will be more delectable than ever, particularly the famous Alsace Corp, the border wine. During this time, Hitler crushes Poland. In 6 days, the German advance columns reach Warsaw. On September the 20th, the city is completely surrounded. The 30 divisions of the Polish army have been totally defeated, powerless in the face of the German armored force. But Warsaw, the first martyred town, resists for a week in spite of daily bombardments by the Luftwaffe.
October the 1st, it's all over. German troops enter Warsaw. This is the first demonstration of the Blitzkrieg, lightning warfare. It's a complete success. Hitler can be triumphant. On September the 17th, Soviet troops also go into Poland. Stalin doesn't want to let Hitler come too close to his frontiers. And Europe witnesses an unforeseen spectacle. Russians and Germans fraternize around a tract in Russia, which proclaims, the German army salutes the Red Army of workers and peasants, for whom it has always had great respect. Poland no longer exists. Before leaving, Hitler has entrusted this new protector, German Reich, to a governor general, police chief Hans Frank of the SS. And he gives him a mission. Settle the Jewish problem. In the west, Hitler has left 30 divisions, stretched along 530 miles of front. Against them, France has been able to concentrate 85 divisions, a unique opportunity to attack. On September the 5th, Operation Star is launched with a great show of publicity. But only 10 divisions advance cautiously on a mile front, going into Germany through the Vance Forest. They take 15 days to penetrate 5 miles into German territory without meeting any resistance. The Germans have suffered enormous losses, announced the communique's project. In fact, they have less than 200 dead. The truth is that the French commander-in-chief, General Gamelin, doesn't believe in an offensive. After the fall of Warsaw on October the 3rd, he orders a withdrawal at night and in secret. And General Beaufray was a captain at army headquarters.
I must say that, in fact, it is Gamelin and Gamelin alone who carries the responsibility for that farce, which was the so-called offensive on the Saar front.
The French army could have made a big offensive.
Not only could have, but should have, for reasons of morale. But they did a half-hearted attempt. If one had made a push at that moment, we would have had almost nothing in front of us. Perhaps certain inadequacies in command would have been shown. One would have had to replace some generals, as they did in 1914. It would have given the army a list and a capacity that it wasn't able to get back later.
It was a lost chance.
It was a completely lost chance. Much more so at that time when the Siegfried Line wasn't even finished. It was the incompetence of Gamelin, who was a person who was entirely, if you like, unprepared to make a decision.
It wasn't only Gamelin. I imagine the government didn't want this offensive either.
Well, as to the government, there was a very curious situation which developed during the winter when I was at army headquarters in Paris. It was the position of Daladier. Daladier, who was a veteran of the First World War and quite brilliant as well, he had remembered the many casualties of 1914, etc., etc., and he had a motto was, one must economize on French blood. In consideration of which, I was charged, personally, by the Army General Staff to put on foot 7 divisions, which, if I remember rightly, were 3 foreign divisions and 3 Senegalese divisions. That was economizing on French blood, wasn't it?
After the invasion of Poland, France expects a German offensive. Edouard Daladier, doubling as Prime Minister and Minister for War, inspects the defenses. He has again brought out his gaiters and his leather coat from World War I. The German attack is awaited, well back behind the Maginot Line. The Maginot Line, an idea dating from 1929. A line of Arctic fortifications, 300 miles long, which runs from Switzerland to Luxembourg. There's only one problem. It can't be extended along the Belgian frontier. because King Leopold wants to safeguard the neutrality of his country. And if the Germans attack through there, it doesn't matter, Marshal Pétain had replied in 1935, we will corner them like rabbits in the Ardennes. The Maginot Line, insurmountable. It took 6 years to build. 1.5 million square yards of reinforced concrete, 150,000 tons of steel. On the surface, one can see almost nothing, because the defense work is below ground, where there are miles of tunnels. Here, 500,000 men lived 120 feet below, like moles. Commander Ganlock spent 9 months of the war here.
Well, life underground is quite hard. It's quite hard because, obviously, in peacetime, there is boredom and inactivity. And from time to time, the soldiers grumble. They suffer from what's called the concrete bug.
The Maginot mentality became a factor that was to prove fatal to French morale. While it gave a feeling of invulnerability, there still remained the hope that the Germans would not put it to the test. An armor plating of concrete and steel. It has become a mystic symbol. Doubt it is to doubt France. Hitler, encouraged by his success in Poland, wants to attack in the west at once. Returning from Warsaw, he summons the commander-in-chief of the army. He orders 50 divisions to be brought back immediately from Poland. A plan of campaign in the west is to be prepared by October the 20th. The German generals are completely opposed to this. It's madness, they say to each other. France isn't Poland. They also remember the First World War. For 2 weeks, they try to convince Hitler. The Polish campaign has revealed serious weaknesses, a lack of preparation. Hitler is furious and proclaims, it is I who decide. I don't retreat in front of anything. I win or I fall. There is a breach between him and his general staff. Certain officers seriously consider overthrowing him with a coup d'etat. And on November the 8th, Hitler narrowly escapes an assassination attempt in the famous beer hall of the Bergenbrau Keller in Munich, where he was celebrating the anniversary of the 1923 putsch. Is it the signal? No. While Hitler buries the victims, the Gestapo hunt the instigators throughout Germany, and the officers who have plotted the assassination abandon their plan. Hitler is still the master. Along the secret line, the German army gets the order to attack in the west on November the 12th, 1939. But on the 12th of November, weather conditions are unfavorable. The order is rescinded. 5 times in 2 months, Hitler issues the same order, but each time he is obliged to countermand it because of bad weather. So, like the French army, the German army digs itself into the Siegfried Line. The two armies are from now on face-to-face, on foot. It's the beginning of the Holy War. The summer of 1939 is over. Winter is coming, and still nothing happens. People begin to hope that the war will end before it has really started. The stalemate continues for months. 5 million Frenchmen, called up to fight, are involved in this phony war, a war of waiting. During this time, the newsreels tried to keep up the morale of a country that was unprepared for war. This one shows French soldiers receiving 2,000 soccer balls that had been donated by an Englishman. The French people saw the soldiers gather to watch films in bomb shelters or to see shows in homes that had been offered for these events. The entertainers of the time went up to the front to sing and dance for the troops. The songs and music contained an element of hope, hope that the war that everyone was waiting for would never happen.
The Allies believe they can win the war by revealing the truth to the German people
rather than bombing them.
Les alliés pénétrés de la sincérité de la cause qu'ils défendent obtiendront la victoire autant par la vérité que par les armes.
Winter has come. In the east, still nothing happens. It's one of the coldest winters that France has known for a long time. Continues to drop. The waiting goes on. Christmas arrives, the first Christmas of war. Along the Maginot Line, the soldiers wonder if there will be others.
And therefore, we had serious deficiencies.
The French army had not kept pace with the ideas that had been adopted in Germany. The tactics and strategies of the French High Command were those left over from the First World War. New ideas had been ignored. An almost unknown French colonel, who had written books which hardly anyone had read, proposed a plan as early as 1936, a war of movement with armored divisions supported by fighter planes. He is 50 years old and commands the 507th Tank Regiment. His name is Charles de Gaulle. On January 26, 1940, he addresses a memo to 80 French personalities. He wrote, "The present conflict will sooner or later be settled by surprise tactics, raids and pursuits in which volume and speed will infinitely exceed even the most vivid events of the past. In the present conflict, to stand still is to be beaten." From the time he takes over the government, Paul Reynaud, who has known since 1936 about Colonel de Gaulle's ideas, demands that the Allies take the initiative. Mr. Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, is reluctant at first, but Mr. Churchill, First Sea Lord, is enthusiastic. During a meeting of the Supreme Council in London, the Allies decide to attempt an operation in Scandinavia in an effort to cut off the steel supply of the Germans. At the beginning of April, the Allies lay mines around the entrance to Norwegian ports, send an ultimatum to Norway and Sweden, and prepare several landings along the coastline. But Hitler accelerates his advance. He takes 4 hours to occupy Denmark and invades Norway. A new demonstration of lightning warfare. On April the 9th, 6 German divisions make a surprise landing. The Norwegians haven't had time to mobilize and attempt vainly to defend themselves, but they're crushed by the Luftwaffe. The Germans have air supremacy at all times. In 48 hours, they have occupied practically the entire country. In Oslo, Quisling, the Norwegian Nazi, has taken power. The king takes refuge in the north, then in London. For Hitler, it's another victory of staggering proportions. 8 days later, the Allies invade and the British land in the middle of Norway. They won't get far. They have to re-embark at the end of a week. For in Norway, the invincible Royal Navy makes a bitter discovery. Supremacy at sea is nothing without supremacy in the air. The Luftwaffe had sunk one of the few British aircraft carriers, the Courageous. By General Betua. In the glimmer of the polar night, the 13th Brigade of the Foreign Legion, a battalion of Alpine troops, and 2 Polish battalions succeed in landing. After 10 days of hard fighting, the French finally take the town. It's the first Allied victory of the war, a victory won on land by General Betua, and which succeeded in stopping the steel supply to the Germans. But not for long. For only 24 hours, in fact. The next day, the expeditionary force is recalled urgently to France. There, the real war has begun. Saturday, May the 10th, at dawn, the German paratroopers of the 7th Division, under General Studer, board the Junkers 52. Objective, Holland.
right, everybody, Joseph Gibson podcasting here, Understanding the Times in Which You Live Today. All right, we're going to wrap up the show. Documentaries there on World War II. We did one on Patton also, so if you missed it, go and get it in the archive. Until the next show, God bless the Republic. Good night, everybody.